Okay, let's get started. Welcome to this episode of Celluloid Fever Dreams, episode 6. Count right? 6. Yeah, 6. As always, I'm your host, Wyndham Jennings, and we're going to take another weekly walk through the weird, wild, wonderful world of overlooked, forgotten, and cult films. This week, our film is going to be Death Becomes Her, which, honestly, I hadn't seen in years. It's one of those films I'd almost forgotten about. You know, it's not one that I see talked about a lot online or, you know, it comes up a lot in discussions with people, you know, friends of mine or people when we talk about funny movies or you know, dark comedies like, you know, Beetlejuice or that ilk. But stumbled across it recently again on HBO Max and decided, no, I have to watch this and I have to talk about it. And I can't remember the last time I watched the movie. Probably, it's been at least 10 years ago, probably longer. I actually went to see it the weekend it opened up, all the way back in 1992. And I really enjoyed it. It is one of those films that, even going back and rewatching it for the podcast, I found it hilarious and fast-paced, and the sight gags and even the special effects today really held up well. But we'll get into all that. As we go along, it's, as I said, it opened up the same weekend as Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And, it did okay. It wasn't really a huge hit back in the day. I think all totaled worldwide, it did about $140, $150 million. And it kind of surprised me that it wasn't a bigger hit. It surprised me that there's not more of a, I guess more of a cult following around it. Is it a bit of an oxymoron to say I'm surprised it's not a bigger cult film? I mean, because after a certain point it would, you know, quit being a cult film, just be a success. I guess is there a tipping point for that? Is there a tipping point between huge cult film and moderate success? But it actually did better than I remembered. You know, doing the research on it, it turns out that they won an Oscar that year for Best Visual Effects, which makes sense. As I said, doing research on the film, I found out about the Oscar and found out that a good chunk of the special effects team for this film went on to work on Jurassic Park, which, you know, at the time came out in 93. And at the time, and well, still does, it sets the benchmark for a lot of visual effects, especially computer-generated effects, which, you know, this is one of the first films to really use computer-generated effects extensively in several shots. But as I said, it really surprised me the movie wasn't a bigger hit. I mean, you look at the people responsible for it, you look at the cast, you look at the work they've done up to this point, the work they've done since then. How this wasn't one of the biggest films of the year. I mean, you assemble this kind of cast. I mean, the main cast, you know, start with Goldie Hawn, who, in my opinion, is one of the best comedic actresses. Did y'all hear that? Hear my elbow pop? One of the best comedic actresses of all time. I mean, her body of work goes all the way back to the 60s. And she has done some serious roles, but, you know, honestly, her comedy time and her comedy roles and things like, you know, Private Benjamin, Overboard, Best Friends with Burt Reynolds, which might actually be another one I talk about on here. I don't know. We'll see. You know, and all the way back to, you know, Laugh-In, the TV show she's on for several years. You know, and she's perfect for the role. You know, her comedic timing, her facial expressions, her, you know, physicality for the role and for the role of Helen is just perfect. And, you know, at the time she was kind of on an upswing in her career. You know, she was producing several hits in a row, you know, and this one, and, you know, like I said, it was a moderate success, but I still feel like it could have been bigger. And you team her with Meryl Streep, who, Yeah, Meryl Streep is actress with capital A. You know, over the course of her career, because I actually looked this up, because, you know, when I was a kid, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you know, Meryl Streep was, well, and it still is. I mean, she's acting royalty. She has earned her place in cinematic history. But over the course of her career, she's been nominated for 21 Oscars. And she was actually, let me check my notes. Yeah, she's nominated for 21 Oscars. She's only won 3. But, I mean, you look at her body of work, and she's, up until, like, a couple of years before this movie came out, it was all these very serious roles. You know, Silkwood, Sophie's Choice, Deer Hunter, Out of Africa. But then you look at the year, you know, from about 89 till 1992, and she just did all these sort of offbeat comedies. I mean, she did She-Devil with Roseanne Barr and Ed Begley Jr., and followed up with Postcards of the Edge, Postcards from the Edge, sorry. And defending, before this film, was Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks, which is another really good movie. Might have to add that to my list and cover it one day. It seems like the 70s and 80s and early 90s were just like a golden age for the type of films I want to talk about. But, you know, it was still at the time, even though this was her fourth movie, to see Meryl Streep in this kind of film. And people even asked her about it, about why she would take on this kind of role. And she said she accepted it because she had never seen a role like it. And it would be, you know, crazy to turn down this opportunity to play this type of character and this type of story. And then you got Bruce Willis, who, Bruce Willis's film career is kind of hit and miss at this point. I mean, he had done Die Hard. I think Die Hard 2 had already come out. Yeah, Blind Date, which is another really funny 80s comedy. But yeah, Last Boy Scout, was that before? Yeah, I think that was right before 91, maybe. With, oh Lord, who was it? Anyway, you know, he had these hits, and he had sort of made a name for himself as an action star, but he'd also done Bonfire of the Vanities, which is considered by some to be one of the worst movies ever made, Hudson Hawk. He had done a blues album, I believe, at this point as well. Sort of up and down, and yeah, I gotta admit, this is one of my favorite Bruce Willis roles. You know, this, because he's always kind of the smart ass. He's really gotten a reputation, you know, now at this point in his career, as like the action star, the big tough guy, you know, especially from the Die Hard movies, from stuff like Last Boy Scout, even Fifth Element, which is probably my favorite Bruce Willis movie of all time, one of my favorite movies of all time. And this is so against so many of the roles that he's done and so many of the roles he's known for. You know, his character of Ernest in this film is just so much against type. I mean, he's the very weak-willed man. He's doesn't have any of, you know, the sarcasm or the witticisms that we see in a lot of other Bruce Willis's roles. He's just the complete opposite of the type of role you usually associate with him, and he nails it. I mean, I actually love him in it. And of course, you know, doing a little research on the film, found out the part was originally supposed to go to Kevin Kline, and watching the film again, I can see that. I can see, you know, the way some of the scenes are played out, some of the comedy, some of the lines they give him, I can see this being a Kevin Kline role, but I still think Bruce Willis nails it, and I can't imagine anyone else in the part. And of course, in a small role, we have Isabella Rossellini, who is, of course, and I just watched the movie, I'm still going to mispronounce this, but Isol, but she's the one who has the potion. And before this, of course, she really made an impact as an actress in the David Lynch film Blue Velvet, which came out in 86, if I remember right. And she's got a small part in one of my absolute favorite movies, Wild at Heart, which stars Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern. And if you haven't seen that, please go out and watch it. It's crazy in all the right ways. It's just a good film. It's one of, if not my favorite, Nicolas Cage film of all time. And I just love Laura Dern. I'll about watch her about anything. And Isabella Rossellini recently, and I actually had to look up to make sure this was her, because it's one of those things that, you see something about it, and then years later, you're like, hey, did that happen? Did I dream it? But, besides Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart, if you had a chance, look up. It was a one-woman show, and I know she filmed some things that went online or were part of a show called Green Porno, which is all about animal reproduction. And to see her dressed up as various animals and explaining, see this woman who, just acting this out for educational purposes, and, and all these silly animal costumes and explaining all this stuff, is so different from so many of the other things that she's done. It is, again, something you need to seek out and see for yourself. But, on top of this, on top of a really great cast, you've got Robert Zemeckis directing it. And Robert Zemeckis is responsible for so many films out of my childhood that I just absolutely loved. The Back to the Future trilogy, Romancing the Stone with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner. Does anybody else remember that movie? Am I the only one? Really? And Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Which is just amazing. It's Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a film that I occasionally go back and rewatch, and it's just really hard to believe this came out in the late 80s. I mean, so much of it and it still holds up, and you just still believe, and it just, oh, I love that movie. Read the book it was based on and hated the book, but yeah, still love the movie. And it's written by David, if I'm pronouncing this right, Kep, K-O-E-P-P. And this is one of his earlier films, but his next two films after this one were Jurassic Park and Carlito's Way. So, it's a pretty good script, pretty, well-known, writer. He's had several big hits. And then you add that up with Alan Silvestri, who, of course, works with Zemeckis on a lot of films, including Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but also did the scores for Clan of the Cave Bear with Daryl Hannah, Flight of the Navigator, and of course everyone's favorite Mac and Me. But you have all this together, and I don't know if it was just bad timing in the release. I don't know if it was just I don't know if it was the reshoots, the rewrites, because the movie went through several endings. I come across three different ones, counting the one used in the film. And there's several scenes and whole characters written out. Tracy Ullman, who at the time, if I remember right, at the time had her TV show, had a small role in the film, and it was completely cut out and written out. The ending involving her was written out. So I don't know. And even going back and rewatching it, I just don't understand how it wasn't a bigger hit, how it didn't, movie that comes up more in conversations about, cult cinema or movies that people love and go back and rewatch and just love and enjoy. Because it is. It's a fun, fast, frenetic kind of film, with a lot of sight gags and it just, one after the other. Once it gets rolling, which, we're dealing with Robert Zemeckis here, so of course, but once it gets rolling, it doesn't let up to let you catch your breath at any point. And there's so many little cute lines and I'm going to say cute. There's so many good lines in it, so many quotable lines in it. And it's a variation. It's one you've seen so many times before, but Meryl Streep and Isabella Rossellini, when Streep's character, Madison, drinks the potion and immediately after it's now a warning. Now? A warning? Now? Or, the conviction with which Bruce Willis, towards the end when he's walking out on the both of them, is, making his big speech about, people who keep promises no matter what are idiots, and with just full conviction is, from now on I'm going to be the kind of idiot I want to be. Or, I don't think they gave him a name, but the little boy toy that Madison is cheating on Ernst with did they give him a name? No, if I did, I didn't write it down, but just that whole little scene where he's trying to convince her he doesn't have a younger woman in there, and she's like, oh, for Christ's sake, at least lie quickly. But let's get a little bit into the film. The story is a very dark take on eternal youth, about the pursuit of it. Ernest is a plastic surgeon. Meryl Streep's character, Madison, is an actress, pretty much a washed-up actress. I mean, the movie begins in 1978 with them doing, people walking out of her musical, talking about, she's washed up, and they even make the joke at the beginning about, can you believe they resurrected her for this role? But Madison and Helen are friends from childhood and frenemies, basically. Madison's got a habit of stealing away all of Helen's boyfriends, and she brings Ernest to watch the play because he needs to pass the Madison test, and of course he fails, and Madison steals him away. And then we flash, we get a nice little montage of them meeting and him and Madison coming to his plastic surgery offices, and then him and Helen have an argument, and then him and Madison getting married, and then we jump forward 7 years, and Helen is a cat lady being evicted from her apartment while she's eating a can of frosting and watching Madison being killed over and over again in one of her films. And we see her locked away in a mental hospital. And the hospital set reminded me so much, and I don't know if this was an Easter egg, I don't know if this was supposed to mean something, or if it was just a generic set, but it kind of reminded me of the whole setup of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Jack Nicholson from 75, I believe. It still reminded me of that, but if it is, it's a nice little Easter egg for people who may have seen the movie. And it's funny because she's in like the group therapy, and it's like the psychiatrist, like, Helen, you haven't talked in a while. Is there anything you'd like to tell us? And she's like, I want to talk about Madison. And it just sets off all the other patients, and you find out she's been locked up for 6 months. And the psychiatrist's like, we need to move forward. You need to eliminate Madison from her life, from your life. And all she focuses on is eliminate Madison. And then we flash forward another 7 years, and we see Ernest and Madison in this huge Beverly Hills mansion. Very unhappy. Madison is sleeping. Her assistant wakes her, and she has all these little patches on her head, and she's sleeping in an awkward position, trying desperately to preserve her youth. And she calls out the lady whose name I did not write down. She has to compliment her as she wakes her up. And Ernest, is a drunkard. He can't work anymore. He's gone from being, one of the world's leading plastic surgeons to being nothing but a mortician, basically. He fixes up people. They call him in for extreme cases, for corpses that need to be touched up. Like when he's reintroduced in the movie, the servant of the house wakes him up with a Bloody Mary, and he orders more vodka for it, and his pager's going off, and you're thinking he's a doctor, but no, they bring him to a funeral home where a actor has died, drowned in his hot tub, with it, you know, while in there with his 18-year-old fiance, and they're like, you have to get the smile off of his face. And another great little line where it's like, oh, I can give him gravity and character, and more. And the Undertaker's like, no. Think of who this is. And people wouldn't recognize him if you gave him character. But we're reintroduced to Helen. She's when we first meet her, Madison asks her about her burgeoning writer career, and Helen admits it's never taken off. But Helen sends Madison an invitation to her book launch. She's turned her life around. She's got a book called Forever Young, haha, and wants to invite Madison and Ernest to it. And they show up, and they're trying to find Helen, and you see a woman from behind that looks very much like Helen from 7 years ago, and then she steps away, and we see Helen now, and Helen has turned her life around. She's, you know, thin, and her hair looks nice, and her makeup's perfect, and her, you know, she's dressed really well. You know, she's projecting, you know, every bit of success and confidence in herself. Just a complete 180 from the person she was 7 years previously, and she's just rubbing it in Madison's face, and, you know, making nice to Madison, telling her, oh, you know, I blame Ernest for what happened. And then when she gets Ernest alone, it's like, oh, I blame Madison for what's happening. She's trying to, put a wedge between them. And, you know, all of this just runs through Madison. And we find out, actually skipped a part, but, you know, she's desperately trying to hold on to her own youth. And think, if I remember right in the movie, both of them are supposed to be 50, which is older than both Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep was at the time, and older than what Bruce Willis was at the time. But, you know, she goes to her spa, and she's like, oh, you know, I need emergency treatments, I need a plasma separation. And I was like, no, we're only allowed to do those once every 6 months. And Madison's like, well, it's been that long, hasn't it? And no, it's been 3 weeks. But that's where we're introduced to Isabella Rossellini's character. Well, we're not introduced to her at this moment. We're introduced to the owner of the spa. And I don't know if this plays into a deleted scene, or if this is something that, should have. I just don't know. He has this weird wink. I don't know if it's him trying to signal if there's something else going on, or if that's him, you know, like a side effect of the potion or whatever. Some sort of hint that something darker is going on. But he's the one who introduces Madison to the idea of, oh no, you can be eternally young. And gives her the card for Liesl. I know I'm mispronouncing this, but oh well, whatever. And she tears the card up and, you know, refuses to even look at it, refuses to even consider it. And then she meets Goldie Hawn's character, and then she goes out and she's rejected by the guy that she's cheating on Ernest with. And she just has a breakdown while driving home in the rain, and, you know, shows up at the house. It's a beautiful mansion where she's met by, this chiseled, muscular man who, you know, tells her she's been expected. Tells her, leads her into, yes, it is Liesl. Now I'm pronouncing it correctly. But, you know, that's where we're introduced to Isabella Rossellini's character, who claims to be 71 years old and is the possessor of this magic elixir that she promises will, grant eternal youth. And she warns Madison that if she drinks it, she'll have to take care of her body because they're going to be together for a long time. And it's just a well-done scene. I love and I know it's just a simple effect, but it's something that I kind of wish we'd see more in these type of fantasy movies, these little reality moments of the bottle. It just has this very fine, you know, diamond point on it, and yet it just stands perfectly vertical. whenever she sets it down on the table, it just stands there, and this is, you know, just impossibly stands there. And I'm sure there's just some simple trick to it, but it's just stuff like that I love in movies, in TV shows, just these little things that sort of give you. And to me, that little detail, I think, sells the idea of the magic more than the swirling images inside. You know, the smoke that, you know, occasionally if you catch it, you know, looks like a muscular man or takes on the silhouette of a woman, you know, a curvy woman, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Just that little bit of tidbit to me just, I think, sells it better than the hundreds of thousands of dollars they probably spent on animating the potion inside the bottle itself. But she takes it and immediately, well, I think I'll say, before she leaves the mansion, she starts to see the effects of it. She looks at herself in the mirror. The spots on the back of her hand, the age spots, have disappeared. Her skin on her face starts to smooth out, and she looks younger. She actually says, "I'm a girl again." And you see her butt firm up. You see her. You see her breast rise up and become, there's no other word to put it for it, perkier. And it's a great effect. And in doing research for the film, I found out that they actually built a rig that was supposed to move Meryl into position, to put it politely. And it just didn't look right. So they actually got her personal dresser for the film to kneel behind her where the camera couldn't pick her up and slip their hands. I don't know if I'm going to assume it was a woman, but don't know. Up into the blouse and move them when action was called. And, you know, just such a low tech and weird effect to sell this thing that they couldn't build something mechanical. They just had to resort to you kneel behind her, try not to get noticed, and it somehow finding that out just makes that whole scene funnier. But of course she goes home and she's going to go back and she's going to, you know, get her boy toy back, and her and Ernest get into an argument, and at the top of the stairs, and he snaps and he's choking her and he lets go. And she's teetering at the top of the stairs. And at first he goes to save her. And then she snaps at him. So he just shoves her down the flight of stairs. And you will see her break her neck and just tumble and tumble and tumble, land in an impossible position at the bottom of the stairs. And while she was off getting the potion, him and Helen, well, Helen had come over and seduced him and convinced him to kill Madison and this really elaborate plan. And the montage of that is delightfully over the top. It is so cartoony and so perfect in tone for the film. I mean, there are people who, yeah, I've seen some online complaints talking about the film isn't, you know, it's very shallow, very flashy, very stylish, but you can't be deep or I don't want to say that doesn't sound right. You can't get hung up on a lot of things that you would in a more serious horror movie about the downsides of immortality. There is a tone set very early in the film that is consistent throughout, and I don't see how making it more dramatic or trying to add, you know, pathos or any sort of gravity to some of these situations would actually make the film better. It is what it is, and you either, you know, hit the ground with it and run along with it, or you don't. And that's basically what it boils down to, in my opinion. But yeah, Helen doesn't die, and there's a beautiful little sequence of her getting up and Ernest taking her to the hospital and her getting put in the morgue and you know, him figuring out that she's, you know, still alive. That's another great line just popped in my head. I should have wrote it down, where you know, she figures out she's dead and passes out. And, of course, they take her to the morgue. And he goes back to the room to check on her. He's like, where's my wife? We took her to the morgue. Oh, she's not going to be happy about that. And it's just great. You know, he takes all his knowledge that he's gained from working on the dead, and he puts her back together. You know, he puts her neck back in place. Her wrist had been fractured. All that, he fixes her. And he airbrushes her, you know, like a car. He's trying to make her as realistic as possible. And I think at one point, he's even painting her eyes. He's talking about he's painting the highlights in her eyes so that they look normal, so that people don't notice, which is a really bizarre moment. But, you know, of course, Helen shows up and, you know, sees what's going on, and Madison finds out they were trying to kill her, and of course she takes a shotgun and blows a hole through Helen, knocking her into a fountain. And that's when we find out that Helen didn't diet and exercise and turn her life around. She's another client of Liesel. And a great effect of her getting up out of the fountain, and you see in Meryl Streep and Bruce Willis's characters through the hole in her abdomen as this water just cascades out of her, and the contacts in Goldie Hawn's eyes as they go just white and dead from her coming back. And you know, that's something I hadn't thought about, because the next sequence where they fight it out and they realize they can't hurt each other, and you know, Madison gets her head knocked twice. Yeah. Yes, it gets like knocked almost completely off by a shovel once, and then down into her shoulders a second time. Yeah, we everybody sort of remembers that sequence of it, but it wasn't until I rewatched it again that I realized that's not really the way the immortality works. It's like, you know, seeing Goldie Hawn in seeing Helen floating in the fountain, and all the blood, it clicked with me. And I don't know, I guess I hadn't seen the movie in so long that, oh no, they were eternally young and healthy until they died. And, you know, that's where the problems began. Because you know, it just seems like I hadn't seen the movie in so long that I just thought, oh, you know, the potion just killed you. But no, watching it again, you know, realized that, yeah, they were still alive up to a point, and that's kind of where the problems began. But from there, it's just like a madcap. They convince Ernest to put them back together one more time, and then they realize that no, it's not going to work, because somebody's got to keep them touched up now that they're dead. And they try to get him, you know, take him to Liesel and try to get her to she tries to convince him to take the potion, and he doesn't want it. He sees all the downsides of it, all the negativity of it, and escapes the party, escapes them. And then we flash forward 38 years to his funeral, and we see the two of them attending his funeral, and see them after they've spent 38 years of touching themselves and up, and the paint jobs and all the fixes they've had to do to themselves. And it the ending is very dark, as we see Helen reach the top of a flight of stairs and trip, and the same position Madison was in that caused all her problems. And Madison goes to push her, and instead they both wind up tumbling down the stairs and breaking to pieces at the bottom, because they're just dried and desiccated and held together with paint and Bondo. And it's a very dark ending, but at the same time, it's not as, I don't know, it's not as dark as a couple of the other endings they almost went with. I know there was a subplot involving Tracy Ullman playing a waitress at a bar that helps Ernest fake his own death, and the one of the endings was, again, years and years later, Helen and Madison held together with Bondo and spray paint, etc., coming across Ernest and Tracy Ullman's character, who was Tony, if I remember right, you know, elderly and still in love and walking along. And when they go to confront him to see if he'll fix them, then they got hit by a car and exploded into pieces. That was one possible ending. Then it was one when Ernest was escaping the party and they were chasing him in a car, and the car went off, they're going to lose control of the car, go off a cliff. The car burst into flames, and the movie ended with their charred skeletons walking out of the wreckage, complaining about, you know, arguing as they always do. But I don't know. I've never seen the deleted scenes. I tried to see if I could find a couple online, but my Google foo wasn't good enough to come across anything. I could only find a written description. But I don't think any of that would really add anything to it. I honestly think that the whole barmaid ending and all that would just have been more of a distraction. I kind of like the lean, sort of frenetic pace of the film once it gets going. I don't think we need anything beyond what we've gotten. Not to say it's a perfect film. I mean, there's only one perfect film, and it's Princess Bride. But it is a really good film for what it is. I mean, if you go in just expecting it, like I do, is it a good movie? Well, it entertained me. So, yeah, it's a good movie. Then you're going to enjoy it, and you should enjoy it, because it's what it is. It should just be just a fun movie, just something to sit and laugh at and be a little weirded out by, and just watch four really good actors playing really good parts, and in one case going against type and going against what they're known for. Well, in two cases, really going against what they're known for and pulling it off well, you know, really well. So, yeah, you need to watch it. If you're just a fan of dark comedies, if you're just a fan of Bruce Willis and want to see him in something different where he's not just shooting stuff or being a smartass, if you're just a fan of kind of weird movies and good special effects, this is one I highly recommend. I really do think more people need to go out and watch this, and this needs to be bigger. You know, I want a Funko Pop of Madison and Helen. I mean, we got one for Hocus Pocus. We got tons of them for Hocus Pocus. Why can't we get one for this movie? A couple of them for this movie. But a little bit of trivia. I mentioned the brain just went crazy. Just went blank. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I thought it was a little Easter egg. Again, might not be. I don't know. But a couple of other things. Helen mentions that the day she drank the potion was October 26th, 1985, which is a nice little Robert Zemeckis Easter egg, as that's the date mentioned in the original Back to the Future movie. That's the start date for all the time travel. The body double for Isabella, for the character of Liesel, when she comes up out of the pool to confront Bruce Willis and is naked, is actress Catherine Bell, who went on to be one of the leads in the show JAG on CBS, Judge Advocate General, for several years, and is also, I think her current work is The Good Witch on the Hallmark Channel, and don't ask me how I know that. Just go with it. But at one point, there was talk back in the 2010 to 2012 about a TV spinoff of the show, but it never really went anywhere. I think Bravo was supposed to do something with that. And I think in 2017, there was supposed to be a musical, a Broadway musical, a revival of the movie as a stage show that Kristen Chenoweth, who, beautiful voice, and pretty funny actress, was attached to. But I don't think that ever went anywhere. In my research, and I'm not really going to talk about this, but I've seen a couple of sources saying the movie does actually have a very cult status in the LGBT community. I'm not really an authority to talk about that. I felt it was worth mentioning to the point that let me check my notes. Give me a second. Vanity Fair has actually done an article on it called "The Gloriously Queer Afterlife of Death Becomes Her," calling it a cult classic and a touchstone of the LGBT community. And even RuPaul's Drag Race has done a Death Becomes Her themed episode. And several drag queens have called the movie an inspiration for either their characters or for them becoming drag queens. But you know, like I said, I'm a middle-aged white guy from the South. I'm not an authority on it. So I don't feel right going into a lot of detail about it because I don't feel like I could do it justice. But I do feel like it's important to talk about if we're going to talk about the film. And if there's somebody out there that does know more about it, would like to, you know, email me or would like to contact me and talk about it, we could do a bonus episode where we do talk about it, where, you know, somebody more knowledgeable about it or has more of an experience about it, and, you know, I'm open to it. This is actually, you know, I mentioned this is like Meryl Streep's fourth comedy in a row at this point in her career, but it was also wasn't a fun film for her. Like I said, she said she couldn't turn down the role because it was so unique. But she talked about how, hang on, let me find the quote. Yeah, she disliked working on the project, saying that, and this is the quote, "My first, my last, my only VFX heavy film. I think it's tedious. Whatever concentration you can apply to that kind of comedy is just shredded. You stand there like a piece of machinery. They should get machinery to do it. I loved how it turned out, but it's not fun to act to a lampstand. You know, pretend this is Goldie right here. No, I'm sorry. Bob, she went off the mark by 5 centimeters. Now her head won't match her neck. It was like being at the dentist." And yeah, I guess it explains why we don't really see Meryl Streep in a lot of sci-fi movies or special effects-heavy movies after that point. But one last little bit of trivia, if I can find it in my notes. Let's see, I mentioned Kevin Klein. Mentioned, yeah, a little bit I caught. I don't know, maybe it's just me, maybe it's just a fan theory, maybe I'm just watching movies a little different since I started doing the podcast, but Ernest, at the end, survives the fall from the top of Liesl's mansion into her pool through a glass ceiling, but previously he had dropped the vial, and we hear it shatter, obviously against the glass ceiling, but he survives the fall. He goes on to live another 38 years, and he's 50 as well, so he's 88 when he dies, lives this active life, marries, fathers 6 kids. I almost wonder, we're shown in the film that just rubbing it across his skin made it young again. I almost wonder if breaking the vial and then falling through the glass into the pool, if he somehow wasn't, maybe not, turned eternally young, but still somehow got an extended lifespan from just being exposed to it. Like maybe when he hits the glass or when he falls into the pool, enough of it gets into him that he's able to, you know, live another 38 years as a very active man, despite being in his 50s. So, that's my thoughts on it. If you got thoughts on it, if you think I need to be corrected about something, if there's something you want to ask me about, if there's some little extra you want to add to it, something that you want me to go back and cover, a movie you want me to watch in the future, feel free to reach out to me. I'm on Twitter at CFeverDreams. I'm on Instagram at Celluloid Fever Dreams. You can see I'm on Anchor, so I know you can leave a voicemail if I remember correctly. I haven't tried it. I don't really know how it works. You can email me at celluloidfeverdreams@gmail.com, but it's CellulOid Fever Dreams, because somehow somebody had already gotten the proper spelling of it. But yeah, feel free to. And you know, as always, if you liked listening to me, you know, tell a friend, leave a 5-star review somewhere. And if you didn't, tell an enemy, leave a 5-star review somewhere. If you'd like to financially support the show, you know, buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com. And, you know, before I wrap up, I want to answer a couple of little things people have asked me about. Like somebody pointed out, I never play my theme song at the end of the episode, and that basically boils down to I forget, generally until about 30 seconds after I've uploaded the finished episode. And somebody else pointed out that I don't do credits at the end, and I don't think about credits because it's just me. You know, I write the show, I, you know, watch the movies, I record it, edit it, I do the social media, I do all the graphics on the websites, I do all the art, cover art for each episode. You know, I do it all myself, so there's not really any credits to do. It's just me. You know, I'm the Tommy Wiseau of podcasting, basically. I'm doing everything. Though, you know, I like his chiseled good looks and velvety elocution. But before I sign off for the week, I want to give a shout out to another podcast, Pentacles and Tentacles. Let me make sure I got that right. I've got a bad habit of reversing things in my head. But if you're into weird history or true history, or not true history, if you're into weird history, true crime, I guess true history. I guess fake history would be an entirely different genre. But anyway, weird history, macabre, trivia, true crime, just general weirdness. Yeah, you guys need to check out Pentacles and Tentacles. They've got a few more episodes than me, so, you know, hey, bigger back catalog to go through. But hey, it also lasts you longer. And it's hosted by, I had to write their names down, it's Shelby Lee and Chrissy. And definitely check them out. They're funny. They're knowledgeable. They're, you know, it's one of those podcasts where it's like listening to, like having a conversation with your friends. You know, one of those things where you'll swap stories, or one of you be like, "Oh, have you heard this?" or "Oh, have you heard that?" You know, and you know, I heard this, or I saw this on the, you know, Twitter, or I saw this on Facebook or something. And it's just really easy going, and I enjoy listening to it. And I want to give them a little shout out and support, because I know Shelby, not going to air a personal thing, I know Shelby had a medical issue recently, and she's going to have to be taking some time off for a while. So she's going to be Chrissy by herself, and just want to throw a little support out there for them. You know, get some more people listening to them. You know, just let them know that, hey, you know, thinking about you. I want you guys to know you got our support. Hope that you get better soon. And, you know, just give them a little love. Let some more people know about them. I know they got a bigger audience than me, but still. Can't hurt, right? And that's going to wrap it up for this week. And, wow, I cannot believe I keep talking so long about these kinds of things. But, you know, until next time, be good to each other, be good to yourself, and take it easy, and I'll be back next week with an entirely different movie. Haven't really thought of which one it is yet. As soon as I know, I'll let you know. Maybe if you follow me on Twitter, I'll let you know there. And until next time, see ya.